Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us, hopefully, Richard Miniter. We'll be talking about his book, Losing Bin Laden. Now, this is really one of the most incredible stories of all time. And if you honestly believe that that we had 12 separate opportunities to kill or capture Osama bin Laden, that's 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 12. 12 different times we could have killed or captured Osama bin Laden, and we weren't allowed to do it. If you think that happened just by accident, why, you are incredibly naive, because in my opinion, there has been an organized effort to protect Osama bin Laden. He is the best enemy that money can buy. And, of course, lots of people will say, oh, well, the reason that this happened is because the administration didn't have the courage to do it, or they thought maybe if they shot at bin Laden, it might not be bin Laden, and they might have accidentally killed somebody else or killed a grasshopper or something. Oh, we can't go ahead and try to take out Osama bin Laden. This was after he had already tried to kill Americans in 1992 after he had been responsible for planning and helping to plan the bombing of the World Trade Center in the spring of February of 1993, and of course the Black Hawk Down episode October of 1993. Well, we have Richard Miniter on the line, and I'm going to let him tell you these incredible opportunities we had get Osama bin Laden or capture him or kill him, and time after time after time we snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory. Mr. Miniter, thank you so much for being with us one more time.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dr. Stan. And pleasure to be back on your program.
Okay, fine. Well, this is a different audience. You were with us for half an hour one time. We'll hope to go the whole hour. And, of course, Richard Miniter has written a book entitled Losing Bin Laden, which is an amazing, amazing story. And in fact, did you get a little frustrated as you were writing that book, with all the opportunities we had and consistently we failed to do what was logical?
Well, it sure was frustrating, because there were so many times which Clinton and his people were close to taking out bin Laden. You could easily imagine how history could have just been just a little different. So, yeah, it was a bit frustrating.
All right, fine. Well, of course, how did it happen that you got the opportunity to talk to all the people that you did and really, of course, gather all this tremendous amount of information?
Well, a little old-fashioned shoe leather. They used to say that an investigative reporter is a redundancy, and today it's an oxymoron. I just started calling them, and a lot of them wouldn't talk to me initially. And I said, well, how about if we don't you don't talk to me, you just listen, and I'll tell you what CIA Director James Woolsey or National Security Advisor Tony Lake said about you. And, of course, once I told them that, they wanted to get their side of the story, and then one thing leads to another.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we bringing other stations onto the network. So we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is Richard Miniter, and of course his book, Losing Bin Laden, must reading for anybody who wants to understand what's going on today. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And our special guest this afternoon is Richard Miniter, an investigative reporter who's written a wonderful book called Losing Bin Laden. And of course, it catalogs 12 separate times when our government had the opportunity prior to September 11, 2001, either to capture or kill Osama bin Laden, have him even turned over to us by the Sudanese government. They were anxious to turn him over to us, and time after time after time, of course, the officials in Washington, D.C. refused to do that. Would you like to just sort of begin telling us a little bit about what happened when the Sudanese government in 1996 wanted to turn Osama bin Laden over to the United States? How did they contact us?
Well, Dr. Stan, let me start at the beginning. February 1996, I think it was February 3rd, they were closing the U.S. embassy in Sudan because of basically all the terrorist attacks that were threats against the embassy and so on. Ambassador Tim Carney, U.S. Ambassador Tim Carney, went to the house of the foreign minister, a guy by the name of Taha, and he brought along David Shin, who was the State Department's director of East Africa Affairs. And over dinner, the conversation turned to bin Laden. And Taha surprised both the ambassador and the State Department official by saying, "Oh, if you want bin Laden, we'll give you bin Laden." A month later, March 3rd, 1996, the defense minister of Sudan, Fatih Erwa, was sent on a secret mission to the United States to meet with Carney and Shin and a State CIA official at a hotel room in Roslyn, Virginia. And there they talked about, again, how to improve relations between the United States and Sudan. The U.S. had sanctions on Sudan, and Sudan at this time was housing a lot of terrorists, including bin Laden. 5 days later, the Sudanese made their extraordinary offer again, this time to the CIA, and with a lot more detail. They revealed that they had been responsible for the arrest and turnover of the infamous international terrorist, Carlos the Jackal. And that arrest went very smoothly, and now Carlos the Jackal sits in a French prison, while bin Laden is still free, of course. And a CIA man thought this was an extraordinary offer. But what happens next is very unclear. The National Security Advisor, Tony Lake, and the counterterrorism czar, Richard Clark, insist that this was not a serious offer, and they didn't take it seriously.
I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought for just a moment. We have to bring one more station on board. All right, well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest, of course, is Richard Miniter, his book, Losing Bin Laden, and he was telling us, of course, that at this point, why people have come to Washington, D.C. from the Sudan, they've offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and turn him over to the United States, and so you were saying that Tony Lake didn't think they were really serious?
He didn't think they were serious, that's right, Dr. Stan, because the Clinton administration had a very simplistic view of Sudan. They didn't realize that bin Laden had sided with an extremist Islamic cleric named Hassan Tarabi against the president of Sudan. So the president of Sudan had a very good reason for getting rid of Osama bin Laden. It would strengthen him internally, politically. It would also help improve relations with the U.S., which were at their absolute worst at that time. So the offer was serious. It was made in good faith. It was made repeatedly. And the Clinton administration then spent the next 2 months debating what to do about it. And I have all the details of those internal debates in Chapter 5 of my book, Losing Bin Laden. But just to summarize here, what they eventually decided to do, they had many different options. They could have assassinated him. They could have agreed to accept him into their custody. They could have transferred him to a third country. What they finally did is decided to order Sudan to just kick him out of their country, to expel him. And this the Sudanese did in May 1996. But the Sudanese warned us. I said, if you send him to Afghanistan, that's where he's going to go. No one's going to be able to watch him. He's going to hate you even more. And you're going to be putting him right back in the center of all those terrorist training camps he's established there. He'll become a much more dangerous enemy and a much more unknown enemy than he is at the moment. It'd be far smarter for you to just take him into custody now. But the Clinton officials refused to listen to Sudanese advice, and they refused to listen to common sense. And the reason I've heard most repeatedly from top Clinton officials why they didn't take bin Laden in 96 is this. Presidential politics. They were afraid they would be criticized for doing a deal with a terrorist state like Sudan, and then on the campaign trail this would hurt them.
But of course, there was another instance, and I saw you'd written that up, where actually the high Sudanese official approached a member of our CIA and said, look, we've got information on all the Al-Qaeda networks and terror cells all throughout the world. We've been tapping at Osama bin Laden's telephone. We know where these people are. We'll give you the files.
That's right. Starting in 1997, they repeatedly offered their voluminous intelligence files on bin Laden. And they had been, bin Laden had been in their country, remember, from April 1991 to May 1996. So they saw everyone who came and went there. They had tapped his telephones, his fax phones. They had informants on his staff, even one of his bookkeepers they had turned into an asset for their intelligence service. So they were getting an extraordinary amount of intelligence about what was going on. Bin Laden actually tried to avoid their surveillance by building a farm 20 miles south of Khartoum along the Nile River. And that, too, they bugged that farm as well. So there was a lot of intelligence that they had. And they had detailed dossiers on not just the handful of people at the top of Al-Qaeda, but the dangerous middle managers in the middle. And these people, we only knew their names, or we didn't even know their names. So learning about these operational commanders would have been very, very useful and valuable to us. But instead, because they had this ideological aversion to Sudan, they didn't want to do any deals. The Clinton people were just blind to whatever benefits might have come out of the files. Now they say, of course, after 9/11, oh, well, the files weren't that valuable anyway. So that the reader can see for himself, I have, I think it's Appendix B of Losing Bin Laden, I reprinted some of the Sudanese intelligence files that I got copies of when I was in Sudan, in Arabic with English translations, so that the reader can see just what they had on us.
Well, you know, I think for our listeners, you have to put things in the historical perspective. And here in 1992, they tried to blow up some hotels in Aden that had Americans in them. 1993, February, the World Trade Center bombing. They hoped to kill 250,000 people. They only got six people killed.
They got seven if you count the unborn child of Monica Smith.
Okay. And then, of course, October, Black Hawk Down, 1995, bombing in Riyadh, 1996. The bombing, of course, the Khobar Towers. And of course, all of these things, and Saddam Hussein is of course, declaring war or jihad on America. And of course, we even won't take his files. This just is so illogical, it defies imagination.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's even worse than that, because the U.S. State Department in 1995 said in one of their public reports called Patterns of Global Terrorism that bin Laden was one of the most dangerous terrorists on Earth. So the very government that's saying that bin Laden's one of the most dangerous terrorists on Earth doesn't want to accept intelligence files on him. It was just incredible. And Sudan repeatedly offered these files through various intermediaries, including Mansour Ijaz and their American lobbyist, Janet McElligott. They offered the British intelligence as well, and the Clinton administration put pressure on the Brits not to take custody of the files. So it was just an incredible story.
Well, my understanding is that the Sudanese even offered to give Osama bin Laden to the Saudi Arabians because, of course, he had been thrown out of that country ostensibly because of his criticism of the monarchy, and of course he had, was responsible for terrorist bombings in their country, and the Saudis wouldn't take him either. Is that true?
That's right. They offered him to the Saudis before they offered him to us. The president of Sudan went on Hajj, which is a sort of a pilgrimage that's a very important part of Islamic religion, to Mecca. And in January 1996, they were on Hajj with the king of Saudi Arabia. And at that point, the president of Sudan offered to turn over bin Laden to the Saudis. And because of Saudi politics, a CIA man once had a very good description of Saudi Arabia. He said, it's a dictatorship run by committee. And maybe it's even two committees, because you've got the clerics on one side, there's about 4,000 of them, and there's another 4,000 or so princes. And to do anything, it must be done by consensus. So you've got to get 8,000 people to agree. It's a pretty unworkable system. And then you add some corruption in there, and you have different factions and families feuding in there, and it becomes a very complex situation. There were a lot of supporters of bin Laden inside the Saudi royal family, inside the wealthy, the class of wealthy industrialists as well, and even some of the extremist Muslim clerics supported bin Laden. So if they were to take custody of him, they would have they wouldn't have a full-blown civil war, but they'd certainly have a sharp division in their society, and it would lead to enormous infighting. So that's why they're afraid to take them.
Well, of course, we could even accept that and understand that. But then, of course, Osama bin Laden moves over to Afghanistan, and he is responsible for the bombing of our embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, and I think 5,000 people wounded. I've forgotten how many were killed, you know. But, of course, then, of course, we're able to watch him with our Predator planes. We've got this sophisticated technology. We even have people on the ground. But time after time, we had an opportunity to take out this man who is, how many times did he declare jihad on America?
At least 5 times.
And so here's a man who's threatening to kill Americans, come over here and commit all sorts of acts of terrorism. And of course, you know, we're watching him. We know where he is. Would you like to tell the story of the Predator? Because this is a very, well, I think it's one of the most fascinating aspects of this. I mean, once again, we snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory.
Absolutely. Well, the Predator is a small plane that weighs about 900 pounds when it's carrying a single Hellfire missile. It's about the size of a small car. But it's a robot-controlled, a drone plane, and they can watch it. It has incredibly accurate black-and-white cameras on it. And the CIA can watch images in its Langley, Virginia headquarters from a Predator plane, even if that plane is 10 or 12,000 miles away. The pictures are coming in live and crystal clear. And 3 times while that plane was flying over Afghanistan in the year 2000, they spotted bin Laden. 3 times they rang the White House. Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor, was consulted, and he went into the Oval Office or up to the White House residence to talk to President Clinton. And 3 times Clinton dithered and delayed and said he had to think about it, and he wants to talk to so-and-so, and he wants to talk to so-and-so. And so by the time he finally got around to making a decision, bin Laden had vanished.
And, of course, the thing is that, now, did they have this armed with a Hellfire missile at that time, do you know, or was it available at least towards the end of the flights of the Predator?
It was available toward the end. Also, we had a Navy submarine off the coast of Pakistan that could have fired a missile as well.
And, of course, I mean, this is really pinpoint accuracy with these missiles from but none of this is done. In fact, eventually, don't they ground the Predator? Because, of course, there's all sorts of infighting, and that way we're no longer able to track bin Laden as efficiently?
That's right. The Air Force and the CIA get into a terrible fight. Who's going to pay for the Predator? The Air Force didn't like it very much because there was no pilot. And the CIA didn't like it very much because it was a threat to their authority. Because what had happened was, originally when they'd get human intelligence, a source would tell them where bin Laden was. CIA Director George Tenet would argue against taking any strong action on the grounds that, this is only one source. We don't have a second source. So Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, was tired of hearing this. And he pushed the bureaucracy. He pushed the Air Force's experimental plane program to crash out and then get the Predator in its modern form up in the sky. They had tested an earlier version of it over Kosovo, but that was a very different technology. And so that Predator was put in the sky just as to countervail the criticisms of George Tenet, the CIA director. So he was very happy to see it grounded, and he was happy to feud with the Air Force because he knew that would take the Predator out of the equation.
And, of course, this is such an effective technique of monitoring. And, of course, you could identify Osama bin Laden because he's 6'5", and most of the Arabs are fairly short. So he was easy to pick out, wasn't he?
He was very easy to pick out. Also, remember, these images are very, very clear. So it's even clearer than watching a normal television screen. So they have a very good idea of what they're looking at and who they're looking at.
And didn't we actually see an example of how they were able to take out one of the terrorists in Yemen here just this last year?
That's right. Yeah, there was a carload in Yemen, and they targeted it very quickly and took it out.
And of course,
and Mohammed Atef, who was the number three guy in the military wing of Al Qaeda, we took him out in November of 2001 with a Predator. We saw him walk out of a house to use an outhouse, and as soon as we positively identified him, the missile was fired, and he was gone.
So they had the ability to do that, and they're going after everybody except for. Certainly the leader of this whole Islamic terrorist movement, and if we get rid of him, you know, this would be the greatest possible thing we could do to stop international terrorism, and time again, we let him go. We'll be right back here, right after this break.
Now, most people would laugh at the idea that there is or has been a secret society. I wanted to tell you about a tape we have. It's a talk I gave before the Concerned Women of America some years ago, and it basically goes back into the background behind the secret society, which was formed in England and eventually came to America and came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes. And how does that secret society that he created impact on you today? If you read the works of Professor Carol Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, you understand that Professor Quigley is probably one of the leading experts today on history, but also a man who had the courage to speak out. You need to get the four-tape set, The Secret Government, to understand what Professor Quigley taught Bill Clinton. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
Hello, this is health journalist Bill Sardi, and there's no better time to establish a biological response kit in your home. In an age when we hear about biological threats, more common are cases of E. coli in our food, cryptosporidium in our tap water, and staph germs, viruses, and molds in our air conditioning system. Why be a sitting duck and run to the doctor after you've got a problem? Why not take something to stay healthy, like Alamex, the all-new 100% pure Allicin garlic extract? You won't find Alamex in stores, but you'll find it by calling 866-405-4000. Alamex is equivalent to 15 cloves of fresh crushed garlic, and guess what? It's odor-free. Call 866-405-4000.
All right, well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time I want to mention the Big Berkey and Berkey Light water filters. And you know, people say, well, why would anybody want a water filter? Well, first of all, they're portable. Secondly, if there ever were a problem when you did not have a ready supply of water, you can use rainwater, dishwater, you can, well, not dishwater, but pond water, and I suppose you could even use dishwater if you had to, but of course, you could use lake water and of course, from a river, and you wouldn't have to worry about it. It's what missionaries have used for 150 years throughout the world. The Big Berkey is made of stainless steel, and put 2.5 gallons of water in the top. It goes down through ceramic filters packed with activated carbon, comes out the bottom, and you've taken out the bacteria, you've taken out many of the chemicals and herbicides and pesticides, or removed large significant amounts of them, and of course the water is very potable. It'll clean up the taste, take out a lot of the chlorine. If you need to get out the fluoride and the arsenic or MTBE, you can get special post filters to do that. The Big Berkey is $239.95. It's available in every state except for California and Iowa. However, there is a filter that's available in every state but Iowa, so it would be available in California. It's called the Berkey Light. It costs $199.95, and of course, if you buy either the Big Berkey or the Berkey Light through Radio Liberty, you get a four-tape set or a video that we produced free of charge. And you can see these water filters. Actually, they're up on our webpage. The Berkey Light is made of Lexan, so you can actually see the water level. This is what you make bulletproof glass out of. Then, of course, the filters are called Black Berkey filters. They're really more efficient than the Big Berkey filters. However, they have to be replaced every 2 to 4 years, depending upon use, whereas the others can be cleaned again and again. Why don't you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this afternoon is Richard Miniter. We're talking about his book, Losing Bin Laden. And, of course, the times over and over again when we could have taken out Osama bin Laden and we didn't do it. Now, didn't they actually have plans to send in troops or commando teams to take him out? Mr. Miniter? Mr. Miniter, are you there? Well, I wonder if we've lost Mr. Miniter. I'm going to have to ask my producer if you'll call him on back again. Mr. Miniter, are you there?
Of course, yes.
Oh, okay, fine. We were just about ready to call you back.
Okay.
Anyway, what about the commando teams? Weren't there plans to send in commando teams or special forces teams?
Yes, there were, but those plans were never approved by Clinton, but they were certainly developed, and the military had extensive planning to send in a special forces team that even scoped out an airfield they were going to use in western Afghanistan. They'd sent in a CIA team to assess that airfield, and with Air Force as well, to assess that airfield. They did a lot of planning. And they were going to send in three teams launched from a U.S. Naval vessel in the Indian Ocean. And if the plan had put in place, it probably would have worked, but Clinton never approved it.
Well, why do you think, certainly after, they had attacked, certainly both of our embassies after they attacked the coal and killed the Americans, you would think that that would have provoked him to take a strong stand against Osama bin Laden?
You would think so. Clinton never really wanted to take the fight to the enemy. There are a lot of Clinton defenders who said the president did a lot of things. But the most of the things that he did involved planning to retaliate or considering retaliation or small, symbolic, but meaningless things like cruise missile strikes at empty buildings. When it came to tough action, he just didn't seem to have the stomach for it.
Well, now, of course, at one time he did launch some cruise missiles at Afghanistan and an aspirin factory in Sudan, whether it was aspirin or whatever it was, but it certainly wasn't producing poison gas as far as we can determine. What's the real story behind that?
Behind the so-called aspirin factory. Well, I went to the factory. It's in a place called Omdurman, which is in north of Khartoum. You can still see it. It has basically been unchanged since the missile strike on August 20th, 1998. They've sealed it so the UN can investigate the claims of the Sudanese, which is that it wasn't producing any weapons at all. You can see thousands of bottles of veterinary medicine littering everywhere in both English and Arabic. They had a UN license to produce animal drugs and drugs for humans as well as part of the oil for food program with Iraq. So there's an interesting little Iraqi connection there, but there's no evidence they were making any kind of chemical weapons.
Well, you would think our intelligence would know that. I mean, certainly, with all the money we put out for the CIA and the NSA, and I don't know what other else.
Well, they were incredibly sloppy. I mean, I talked to the German ambassador to Sudan, who told me that he had visited the site about 3 months before the cruise missile strike and spent something like 6 hours touring the facility and talking to workers and so on. And they let him go anywhere and do anything. In fact, he took numerous pictures, but we never, there were many public visits to this facility. Why they didn't just attach a CIA officer under diplomatic cover to one of those visits and have a look around, I don't know. Now, they did say initially that they had a soil sample that contained EMTA, and EMTA is a precursor for VX gas, but then it turned out that they had mishandled that soil sample, and that what actually all the soil contained was Roundup, which you use for killing weeds. So it was just bad intelligence. They'd also gotten some reports from a Tunisian operative the CIA had hired inside Sudan to give them reports. But the problem is this guy was very poor, and the per capita income, of course, in Sudan is $400 a year. They were paying him $100 per report. So for a few hours in front of his typewriter, if he could have a clever enough imagination, he could make a pretty good living to feed his family. So that's pretty much what he did. And then about a year before the missile strike, the CIA had to publicly withdraw more than 100 reports from Sudan because it was based on this kind of faulty intelligence where they paid for stories that just weren't true.
All right, fine. Now, of course, you said that you felt that that when they launched the attack, on Afghanistan, that, that there was a certain amount of justification. Many people felt that this was launched as a cover for the Monica Lewinsky investigation to detract our attention from that. When we get back, though, I do want you to go into your take on that missile attack and why it failed, because certainly you would anticipate that we would be able to know where bin Laden was, and it only takes a few moments, a few minutes at the most, for those cruise missiles to travel from the Arabian Sea over there. We'll be back in just a minute, and if you have any questions or comment, our guest is Richard Miniter. His book, Losing Bin Laden, something you must read. Give us a call right here at Radio Liberty. Thank you.
Well, if there's any one tape that you should hear, it's my talk on geopolitics, an untold story that is vitally important if America is to survive as a free nation. It goes into the background of the forces that have created the wars of the 20th century, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. We go into the ideological and the spiritual battle behind the forces that have moved America from crisis to crisis and are currently undermining the very fabric of our society. That number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and the tape, Geopolitics. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of my talk on geopolitics.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I just want to mention a couple of the things we carry here. One of them, of course, is the Miracle 2 soap products, and we can't make any claims for them. But I will honestly tell you that we have many, many people who do use these products who tell us the most amazing stories about rashes going away or acne clearing up or digestive tract or either lower or upper intestinal tract improving dramatically with the use of the neutralizer. I've used the soap for, a couple of years now, and I'm sold on it. I wouldn't be without it. The gel, if you have anything that hurts or aches or why this gel would help you, I have no idea at all. But, of course, we've heard this story from so many people, and I've used it myself. And, I think that if you try these products, you'll find they truly are very unusual. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Ask for the Miracle 2 soap products. You can look them up on our webpage at radioliberty.com. And if you buy a set of this, you get an introductory set at a reduced cost. And then, of course, I want to mention Phonopoly. It's a program to teach children how to read phonetically and spell phonetically and pronounce words phonetically. And, of course, we think it's an excellent, excellent product. You can teach a child to read in about 16 hours, and, of course, it will change his life because now he understands the basis of the English language, the 40 sounds, the 12 basic rules. And what a wonderful, wonderful gift. The ability to read and read well. And then we also carry the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum. Take your child from grammar school to high school graduation on 22 CDs for $199.95. Phonopoly is $139.95, not $300, $400, $500, $600. Get both products at Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Richard Miniter, and, of course, his book is Losing Bin Laden. If you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I'd just like to get on to a different subject, and that would be James Woolsey, the head of the CIA, who was picked by Bill Clinton to become the director of the CIA. And then, of course, because of a disagreement between Mr. Woolsey and the president, the director of the CIA, responsible for protecting the American people from subversion, and he couldn't get in to see the president. Would you tell that incredible story?
It's an incredible story. I interviewed Jim Woolsey a number of times, and before the book was printed, he read the entire manuscript of Losing Bin Laden just to ensure the accuracy. So Jim's a great American. He was very serious about fighting terrorism. But unfortunately, President Clinton was not as serious. Early on, Jim Woolsey was approached by Bruce Lindsay. He was a lawyer, a longtime friend of Clinton's, and a concierge, kind of Clinton. And he said that he was coming on the president's behalf, and he wanted a friend of Bill's put on the CIA's payroll. And in fact, this friend was supposed to become the general counsel, the top lawyer to the CIA. And Jim Woolsey kind of shook his head and said, well, we already have a general counsel, and she's great. I'm going to keep her. And at that point, Lindsay got a little threatening. He said, you know where this is coming from, right? And what had happened was there was a guy who couldn't even pass a security background check, who was supposed to be given this job just because he was a friend of Bill's. And we saw a lot of this in the early Clinton administration, a lot of friends of Bill who really weren't qualified, were put on the payroll of various government agencies. Some of them, like Webb Hubble, were supposed to run the departments where they were really serving in a number three or number four capacity, but because they were Bill's friend, they were supposed to really run the department. And this ended up leading to scandals. Many of these people had criminal backgrounds. And so, in a way, it's good that Woolsey stood up and didn't let this friend of Bill be put on the CIA's payroll, because otherwise the CIA would have been dragged through scandal, just like the Justice Department was. But there was a real cost to be paid. As a result, to punish him, Clinton refused ever to meet one-on-one with CIA Director James Woolsey. So for 2 years, even though Woolsey tried, he'd go to the White House with the briefer. Every day the president receives an intelligence briefing, and sit in the hallway outside the Oval Office, hoping the president would call him in, and the president never did. Sometimes the president wouldn't even call the briefer in. He would just say, "Oh, I'm a speed reader. I'll call you if I have any questions."
The CIA is giving a daily briefing to the president, and he'll never talk to the man who's in charge of our Central Intelligence Agency.
That's right.
How childish can you be?
Well, that's a question for the Clintonites, isn't it? It was just an extraordinary story. I mean, it had been reported before that Woolsey didn't get to meet with Clinton, but only in my book do you read the reason why. It's because he refused to put a friend of Bill's on the payroll.
And what was this story about the airplane that crashed into the White House?
Well, see, this just shows you the attitude of people in the West Wing of the White House in the Clinton years. A plane crashed near the West Wing, and the staffers joked, "Oh, that must be Jim Woolsey trying to get a meeting with the president."
Well, you know, everybody knows what's going on. You know, the one thing about Bill Clinton was he was loyal to his friends, and he made the lives of his enemies very, very miserable. That's not an admirable thing, but he certainly had a tremendous loyalty to the people who came up with him from Arkansas. He looked after the people, you know, who went along with him and supported him.
Yes, he did. But the mafia dons have the same quality.
Absolutely, and similar in other respects as well. And when the safety of America is at hand, and of course people say character doesn't count, I think it does count. And I think, of course, what happened on September 11th can be directly tied, to the attitude and the failures of William Jefferson Clinton.
Well, I don't understand, Doctor, people who say that character doesn't matter in a leader, because character matters in your auto mechanic. Would you go to an auto mechanic you think it might be a crook, might overcharge you? Or to a home builder who's supposed to use the best wood for your house? If he uses shoddy wood, your house might fall down and crush your children. No, of course not. You look for character in everyone you deal with in your normal life. So the idea that character doesn't matter in a president, but it matters in everyone in your daily life, this is just such a contradiction. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, of course, it's been said that it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If it's said often enough, people will believe. And I've heard people make the same statement, and I agree with you totally. I mean, to have a man without character in the White House is indeed a frightening, frightening concept, and it should be frightening to everybody out there in the listening audience today. Well, of course, you know, this whole thing about Osama bin Laden. Now, do you get at all into what happened with the war with Afghanistan, or at what point do you actually end your book?
Well, the book ends with the last day of the Clinton administration.
All right, so
the history of Clinton and bin Laden. And it ends with Bill Clinton staying up late at night, not signing a last-minute retaliation plan on bin Laden, but signing pardons for all of his well-connected friends.
And, of course, there were even chances or opportunities as he's leaving the office, of course. And he doesn't have any excuse because he's not going to have any political ramifications on him. And yet he refuses to take out this man who will very, very soon coordinate a plan to kill 3,000 Americans.
That's right. Well, 3,000 Americans would still be alive today if Bill Clinton had taken one of those 12 chances to kill or capture bin Laden.
Well, as you tell this story across America, what sort of response do you get from the listening audience?
Well, I get a range of responses. Some people say, well, thank God, somebody is finally telling me what I've always suspected. I'm finally seeing all the facts and evidence. And many people are surprised to learn that my best sources were top Clinton administration officials themselves who were frustrated by the president. And the level of detail and the amount of citation and factual backup is also impresses some people.
Well,
but then a lot of other people are very, very critical. They accuse me of being a right-wing assassin who's just trying to point the fingers at Bill Clinton and so on.
Well, no, I was very impressed because you do document everything, and I think that's so vitally important in any book of this sort, is where do you get this information, you know, and how can I document and make sure that it's true, because I'm not going to talk to James Woolsey, but certainly so many of the other references that you give will be excellent. I mean, this will be a classic book that will be used by scholars of the Clinton administration, I'm sure, for decades to come.
I sure hope so.
I hope so, too. How is it doing as far as the selling is concerned?
Well, it's the fourth week on the New York Times bestseller list. But if you notice, the mainstream media, they don't like to write about it. It hasn't been reviewed in any major paper except for the Washington Times, which was reviewed by Reagan's defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger. The New York Times hasn't reviewed it, the Washington Post, the LA Times. They're all afraid of it for some reason.
Well, I think that they certainly don't want people to ask the very logical question, how could it possibly be that the fair-haired boy that we supported through thick and thin, that we were able to champion even after Monica Lewinsky, would, of course, have left Osama bin Laden in place, and which, of course, was a prelude to what happened on September 11th. I don't think they want to admit that they share a sense of responsibility for what happened.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Would you like to cover what you did in your book about why it was that you feel that when, of course, Bill Clinton did do one thing that seemed to be right, and that was launch the cruise missile attack on bin Laden, just about the time when Monica Lewinsky was about to testify before the congressional committee. Now, I had always thought that this was sort of a cover-up. You didn't think that. Would you like to cover that?
Well, you know, with Clinton, I mean, the worst suspicions so often turn out to be right. But in this case, I think the national security argument for retaliating against terrorists for an attack which killed hundreds of people, including more than a dozen Americans, they blew up two U.S. embassies on August 7th, the day before Monica Lewinsky admitted that she was going to go to the grand jury and tell the truth, not the cover story that Clinton had told her to tell. And they had the blue dress as well. And they hadn't yet revealed what the testing of the DNA testing of that was going to reveal. So, in that environment, the embassies are blown up. Now, certainly, Clinton benefited politically from those cruise missile attacks, but purely as a matter of national security, when someone blows up our embassies and kills our people, if we fail to retaliate, we just invite more and more attacks. I think the problem with Clinton is not that the scandals made him do too much. I think it made him do too little. He should have been far more aggressive in attacking bin Laden and bin Laden's minions than he was.
Well, now, of course, then you think that this was, considering the timing, this was a political decision to at least to show that America would take a strong stand. This was not simply a cover for Monica?
Well, the national security argument for it is sound. I suspect the real reason he signed off on it was the political benefits. Because if you notice, this was the only time of all the terrorist attacks that bin Laden masterminded against Americans in the Clinton years. This is the only one that Clinton retaliated on. So I find that a bit suspicious. But I'm not going to join on the wag-the-dog criticism of Clinton, because I supported those missile strikes. I think we should have done much more of them. If we don't actively fight terrorists who are fighting us, then we're just simply opening up our own people to slaughter. And that, to me, seems contrary to what the commander-in-chief is supposed to do. He's sworn to protect us from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So he should be out there destroying terrorist networks, not ignoring them.
Amen to that. Well, now, of course, why didn't we get Osama bin Laden? Because we had intelligence. We knew where he was. How did it happen to be that he knew what was going to happen, was able to get away before the cruise missiles come raining in?
Well, that's a great question, because it's an untold story that I tell the first time in losing bin Laden. What happened was Clinton's people had worked themselves up into a frenzy. What if the cruise missiles, which are relatively slow-moving missiles, they move at about 400 miles an hour, about the speed of an airplane, and they take many hours to go from the Navy cruiser to their targets in Afghanistan. They were afraid that the Pakistanis would pick them up on radar and think there was a missile strike from India, and therefore the Pakistanis would launch atomic weapons against India and start a nuclear war. So the idea was that just as the missiles were about to enter Pakistani airspace, a U.S. general who was meeting with the Pakistani government's chief of staff would say, oh, by the way, in about a minute, U.S. cruise missiles are going to enter your airspace. Don't worry, it's not an attack from India. Well, what happened was, when the general did as he was ordered, the chief of staff said, oh, well, excuse me just a moment. he went into another room and made a phone call to the head of Pakistani intelligence. And that person is believed to have phoned Osama bin Laden. One of the survivors of the missile strike in Afghanistan did say that bin Laden had received a phone call and rushed out of the camp. So therefore, bin Laden was able to escape for about 45 minutes before the cruise missiles arrived.
Well, didn't they have any concept of the fact that the Pakistan military, and certainly Pakistani intelligence, was in bed with bin Laden? Were they that naive, really?
I think they were, and I think they didn't listen to the military experts and the intelligence experts. They saw everything through the lens of politics. That's how they viewed everything. And so they didn't want to be blamed for starting a problem in South Asia, in India, between India and Pakistan. And that political and diplomatic problem worried them much more than whether or not they got bin Laden.
You know, I'll have to admit, when I read your book, I got so angry because of course, time after time after time, we find the same deference to politics and not taking the right actions, and then telling the Pakistanis, who obviously were going to tell bin Laden, and so he leaves about 45 minutes before the cruise missiles arrive. And I don't know how much one of those cruise missiles cost, but they're not something that you certainly buy at at Kmart. And of course, how many did we lob into there?
About 80.
Now,
the interesting thing is, I don't know if you noticed this in a footnote, two of the missiles did not explode. And so bin Laden's men dug them up, and they were, of course, wrecked on impact, dug them up and sold the guidance components to the Chinese, who then used it as the basis of the guidance for the missiles that China is developing. So Clinton inadvertently helped the Chinese increase their missile program.
Yeah, well, you'd think they'd occasionally make a mistake in our favor, but unfortunately that doesn't seem to be the case. Well, do you have any parting thoughts at all for our listeners today?
Well, my parting thoughts are these, that, you know, in about a year we're going to have to make a real decision in America. Do we continue with the war on terror the way Bush has fought it, or do we go back to the way that Clinton fought it? And if you're having to make up your mind about that, and you're debating with your friends and neighbors about how to make that decision, do we continue with Bush's method or we go back to Clinton's, I think you ought to look at the history in my book, Losing Bin Laden, and in other books, really educate yourself about what happened in the Clinton years. Because if we decide to go back, people should be very clear-eyed about exactly what happened in the Clinton years and exactly what that choice involves.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I know my audience has enjoyed it, because ordinarily we'd have all sorts of calls. I think nobody wanted to interrupt you. So thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, that's a shame. I would have loved to talk to your audience.
All right. Well, bye-bye, and thanks so much. Well, maybe when you get your next book, we'll have another round at it.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. I'll be happy to come on your program anytime, Dr. Stan.
Thanks so much. Right, bye-bye. Well, this, of course, is Richard Miniter, and his book is Losing Bin Laden. It's must reading, and, of course, if you'd like to get a copy of it, we will get those for you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then we carry another very, very good book. It's called Crude Politics, which is the next step, and that, of course, goes into the Afghan War. It's written by Paul Sperry, who is the chief correspondent for WorldNet Daily, stationed in Washington, D.C., who's had an opportunity to talk to the Green Berets who came back, the Special Forces who came back after the Afghan War. And, of course, the most incredible thing about that is that they weren't allowed to try to get Osama bin Laden. Now, we can be very critical of George Bush, pardon me, of Bill Clinton, and we should be. But nobody has ever pointed out that it wasn't that we couldn't get Osama bin Laden, that Osama bin Laden was so much smarter than we were. The Green Berets were not allowed to go after him. And basically, what the administration did was send in some Afghans to get him. And the Afghans loved bin Laden. And, of course, they helped him to escape across the border into Pakistan, where, in all probability, he's living today. Now, that book, Crude Politics, is a fascinating, fascinating book. We do carry that. I think it's a very important book because it goes into the fact that what the war in Afghanistan was all about was not getting Osama bin Laden and not getting Al-Qaeda, because if it was, we failed miserably. And of course, when you specifically keep the Green Berets from doing what they're doing, you do that intentionally. We went to war with Afghanistan to do away with the Taliban so that we could build, so we could go ahead and build an oil line across there. This book documents so very much of the material of the tie-in between Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Richard Armitage, and the people who surround the president today and the oil lobby. Crude Politics, available through Radio Liberty. Losing Osama Bin Laden, available from Radio Liberty. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. War.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let me just mention a couple of other things. One, if you're out there and you're struggling with your health care costs, or you don't have any health care insurance, and you just really can't afford it with fabulously high prices we have, let me suggest a Christian health cost sharing program called MediShare. That's a Christian health cost sharing program. And if you'd like to know more about it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask about MediShare. I don't think you'd be sorry you did. And of course, we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to setting up an Institute of the Constitution in your community, in your church, in your neighborhood. And this is basically videos. There are three videos with four half-hour lectures on each one. So you have 12 half-hour lectures by Dr. John Eisbo, who is a constitutional lawyer, professor of constitutional law. And he explains to you about our Christian heritage, the foundation of our freedom. You see, if you go back 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, everybody in this country, everybody in the world knew we were a Christian nation. But there's a conspiracy against God, and the people who hate Christianity have been working ever since then to remove these facts from our textbooks. And so you can actually begin to educate yourself and others. We have to understand our heritage of freedom. Why we're a republic and not a democracy? Why this country was founded with limitations put on the power of the central authority so men could be free? Call 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068, and ask about the Institute of the Constitution. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and this is the time, of course, when I need to remind our listening audience that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and as you know, we do 5 hours a day on radio and shortwave and internet and satellite, but it's an expensive proposition. And, of course, if you believe that there's a problem, and there's any way you could afford to help us, we'd be appreciative. Ordinarily, we suggest whatever people can give, but if they'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, they'll get our four best tapes, they'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, they'll be helping us as we reach out across America on a regular basis, bringing you programs like you just heard, this program with Mr. Richard Miniter. So if you'd like, of course, to join the Radio Liberty family, again, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Now, if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter to see what it's all about, you can call that number, and we'll be glad to send you on. Suggest maybe the September newsletter, because it contains the suppressed testimony of Mindy Kleinberger, I believe it is, Kleinfeld. She testified before the Senate House Select Committee, or the committee that's investigating 911, in March of this year. And, of course, her testimony was actually censored by the media. You didn't see it written up at all. And the average individual has no idea what she said. But you need to understand, it was Mindy Kleinberg. You need to understand what she said. And, of course, the comparison between what happened on December 7th, 1941, and what happened on September 1st of the year 2001. And there is a similarity between what happened on December 7th and what happened on September 1st, especially as you read Mindy Kleinberg's testimony. So we hope that many of you will want to get that newsletter and maybe even want to subscribe to our newsletter. Then, of course, let me suggest you go to our website at radioliberty.com. Now, you can pull down our newsletters there free of charge, and you have our permission to duplicate them. You can listen to our radio programs 5 hours every day and not get much of anything accomplished, but there are really people who do listen to the programs on the American Freedom Network and on Genesis Network and on the Radio Liberty Network, and of course make copies of those programs and pass them out, because this is how we are reaching people, and our audience is growing. People telling people telling people. So again, the website is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Please tell your friends and acquaintances about our website and encourage them to listen to it. You can call your local radio station, ask them if they would be interested in carrying this program. And many stations are looking for interesting programming to carry. Certainly you can tell your friends about our radio programs and suggest that they listen. And then you have our permission to give them copies of our newsletters. And a lot of people don't want to hear what's going on, so find out what they're interested in. Maybe they're concerned about the economy or the jobs leaving the country, or maybe they're concerned about the vaccination problem, or maybe they're concerned about the AIDS epidemic, or maybe they're concerned about global warming, or we have tape sets on all of these issues to bring things into their sharp focus so people will understand that everything is being manipulated. And the ultimate goal, a one-world government, a new world order, and the loss of all freedom as we know it. And so we hope that many of you, of course, will pray for America, that you'll pray for our leaders and our ministers, but that you'll pray for revival, because I really believe if the American people don't turn back to God, why, God will never again bless this nation. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you again with more fascinating programs, this is Dr. Stan saying goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.